This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Kathy Pryor, a writer and good food advocate based in Seattle, Washington, and program manager for the Washington Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative, sponsored by Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility and Healthcare Without Harm. Kathy received an MA in Environment and Community with a focus in local and sustainable food systems from Antioch University, Seattle. She has been involved in a variety of projects promoting healthy local food and is author of Sylvia Spinach, a book for children published in 2012 by Readers to Eaters. Kathy Pryor is here today to discuss the Washington Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative and to tell us about some local efforts to promote healthy, sustainable food. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's great to have you. What led to your personal interest in local, healthy, sustainable food?
You know, it's an interesting question. I moved to the mountains of Idaho shortly after college to be a ski bum for a few years. And one of the things that was really eye-opening to me was the localized food systems that you have in a region that is frankly hard to access in the winter months. So I had a lot of friends who were hunting and fishing and would be foraging for berries and canning jams and things like that during the summer. And honestly, I thought of food as something that came from the grocery store shelf. I never really had been aware of food being something that an eater could really have control over. And so after I got done skiing and decided it was time to go and look for a new line of work, I started thinking about our food system, and I started thinking about some of the justice impacts of things like pesticide exposure in farm communities, animal welfare with things like artificial growth hormones, antibiotic overuse, that sort of thing, and really just took a closer look at something that I had always taken for granted. And once you take a closer look, it's really hard to look away.
Let's talk now about the Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative. Why was this initiative started?
This initiative was started in 2005 for a couple of reasons. One of those reasons is the sheer financial power of the healthcare sector. If you think about it, hospitals serve meals 3 times a day, 365 days a year. They serve a lot of food, and the average U.S. hospital is serving over 1 million meals a year. So just by the sheer numbers, we realized that hospitals could have a tremendous impact on the type of food that is available through distribution systems, and also could have a tremendous impact on their local food communities if they were to start buying, you know, from farmers, from businesses directly. The second part of that has to do with something I like to call the moral authority of healthcare. If you look at statistics from the past 10 years, nurses are consistently the most trusted profession in the United States. And doctors and pharmacists, they're all in the top five there too. When people in healthcare speak, the public listens. And so we really realized that people in the healthcare industry, hospitals, had this tremendous important role in their communities to redefine what healthy food should mean.
What is the Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative, and what is your goal?
The Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative asks hospitals to buy more local and sustainable foods for their cafeterias and patient meals, and at the same time, model healthy eating practices for patients, staff, and visitors. And when we talk about healthy eating practices, we're talking about it on a little bit of a different level than you would normally hear from, say, a government public health entity, something like that. We're really looking at the whole food system. So we're asking hospitals to think about what chemicals were used on the farms that grew the food that they're purchasing. And we ask them to prioritize things like organic or salmon safe, Food Alliance certified, something like that, where we know that there are either no or reduced chemicals being used on the farm. We also ask them to think about bigger issues with animal welfare, antibiotic overuse. Particularly, the antibiotic issue has become hugely important, as we see now that over 80% of the antibiotics used in the United States are fed to animals in agriculture. And we see skyrocketing rates of antibiotic-resistant infections. If you look at a graph of rates of antibiotic-resistant infection and the times we started feeding antibiotics to animals, there seems to be a really direct correlation. So we ask hospitals to think about that. You know, they're on the front lines of dealing with these issues. And so we ask them to think about the whole system in their food purchasing. We also ask them to think about what they're telling people in the cafeterias. If somebody goes to their physician and their physician says, you know, you should really cut down on fats and sugars and red meat, and then they go down to the cafeteria and the option is a burger and fries and a mega jug of soda, there's something wrong with that messaging. And so one of the things we realized was that we really need to get more consistent in the way that we talk about this.
The initiative has developed a pledge that you've asked hospitals to sign. Would you outline the key elements of the pledge?
Absolutely. The Healthy Food and Healthcare Pledge has been signed by, I believe the latest numbers I saw were 415 hospitals nationwide. We have 22 here in Washington State who've signed. And what this pledge is an institutional commitment to taking on this kind of work. And the hospital can do it however they see fit. Some of the hospitals prioritize organic, some prioritize local. I have hospitals who are ripping out their deep fryers and trying to get soda out of their cafeterias. Really, they're doing some incredible work. But really what it's committing to is realizing that food is not only a combination of nutrients. We're not just looking at it in terms of nutritional quality, although that's certainly a component. We're also looking at it from an environmental component and a social justice perspective, making sure that the people who are involved in food production are not being adversely affected by doing so.
Would you elaborate on how you are encouraging hospitals to reduce their carbon footprint?
We have a couple really interesting programs on that. One of the easiest ones to think about would be waste reduction. So we ask people to think about reduced packaging. You know, if you're going to have disposable serviceware, which we discourage, and you have the option to have a plastic fork wrapped in a plastic bag, you know, maybe you could order the plastic fork that didn't come wrapped in a plastic bag. That's an easy one. So certainly there's a lot of waste stream issues. I would say probably the most exciting work that we do in terms of carbon footprint reduction is something called the Balanced Menus Challenge. And the Balanced Menus Challenge started a few years ago when hospitals in California realized they wanted to prioritize sustainable meat production. But there was not enough sustainably raised meat in the state of California to meet the needs of their healthcare system. So we came up with something called the Balanced Menus Challenge, which is a 20% meat reduction over one calendar year. And at first we did it just as a way to save money and to try and get menus more in line with nutritional guidelines. But once we partnered with Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, they pointed out that actually this was going to have tremendous savings in terms of a facility's carbon footprint. And a lot of that has to do with the heavy carbon footprint of beef. And so we've had a lot of hospitals reduce their beef consumption, and that has a tremendous impact.
What has the Washington Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative accomplished so far?
Some of the most exciting things that have happened just in the 4 years that I've been working on this initiative, Overlake Hospital in Bellevue has created an organic cafe. They are really sort of my dream come true for what the future of healthcare will look like. They just this year replaced their old vending machines with 100% healthy vending across campus. They're trying to find ways to eliminate high fructose corn syrup throughout all of their food service operations. They also, you know, do really interesting things like they joined a seafood purchasing collaborative where they're buying their fresh wild salmon directly from fishermen in Washington State. So there's examples like that. We have examples like a small hospital in Cedar Woolley, United General Hospital, where he does a Farm Fresh Friday. Every Friday afternoon, the products on his menu all came from within 50 miles of the hospital. And he's really working with a lot of grass-fed beef farmers. He's got an organic chicken, really just doing fantastic work in supporting the farmers in his community. On a more basic level, we've got hospitals throughout Seattle doing things like purchasing cage-free eggs from a Washington egg farmer. Before this came along, everybody was sort of buying their eggs from anonymous farms in the Midwest or the southeastern United States. And through their combined purchasing, they've been able to begin purchasing from a five-generation family farm right here in Washington State. So we're not only supporting farmers in our community and the future of agriculture in our state, we're also kind of cutting down on the food miles associated with those products. And we're trying to do that category by category.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kathy Pryor, a writer and good food advocate and program manager for the Washington Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the challenges that hospitals face in trying to serve healthier and more sustainable food?
I would say probably the biggest challenge is that unhealthy food makes money. And unfortunately, there's sort of a running joke in a lot of food circles. Why does a salad cost more than a hamburger? And that's a big answer to a small question. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with some of the issues we're facing in the current farm bill and the way that subsidies are allocated for commodity crops versus fresh foods. I won't get into that, but I will just say French fries are cheap and they sell. And there's a huge profit margin to be made on things like bottled soda, things like that. And unfortunately, these hospitals are used to their cafeterias operating with a profit. Unlike most other components of a not-for-profit healthcare sector, where really the aim is to heal people, to make them well again, for some reason, hospital cafeterias are used to making money. And actually, just 2 weeks ago, I had the privilege of touring Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's campus here on Lake Union, and their food service director told me that they have incredible food, lots of fresh stuff, lots of organic, antibiotic-free poultry and beef. And the food service director told me that the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance has actually opted to run that cafeteria at a loss. They subsidize that cafeteria because they have so many students and maybe people who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford the fresh foods, that they just recognize that it's not going to be a profit generator for the hospital, and that's okay. So that's one of the big challenges. I would say that the secondary prong to all of this is patient meals. And the amount that hospitals are reimbursed for patient meals is determined by insurance companies. And so they have a very limited food spend within each menu. It's definitely not as bad as something like public schools would be. I mean, really, hospitals are practically wealthy when you look at it compared to the dollar plus that most public schools are trying to feed kids with. But it's still a modest amount of money to serve someone three meals a day. And then finally, the last part, unfortunately, hospital kitchens have gone much the same way as school kitchens in that they've gotten much smaller. They've become spaces for reheating rather than cooking. So oftentimes, if a hospital decides they want to make these big changes, they hire a chef, they want to start creating scratch menus, they have to do a kitchen remodel, which is a pretty major expense all in itself. And they have to train people with knife skills. They have to train people how to create a menu, how to think seasonally about what products are currently available. So there's a lot of challenges, everything from the financial to the emotional to the technical.
Well, you mentioned that a number of hospitals have signed the pledge. So for hospitals that haven't signed, what do they give as a reason for not wanting to sign?
You know, it runs the gamut. I would say one of the most common things I hear are administration just wasn't interested. They're afraid that it's going to commit them to something that they're not necessarily committed to. And I hate to say this, I think sometimes people are really afraid to rock the boat, especially somebody who's been in this position for 10, 20 years. They're doing fine. They're getting good performance reviews. They're on budget, you know. I mean, really, they don't have a motivation to change unless it's something that they are personally passionate about. And the hospitals that I find who have the most incredible results are the ones who have some sort of an in-house champion driving these changes.
What are your future plans for the Washington State Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative? What will be your focus over the next couple of years?
We've got some exciting stuff coming up. One will be some work I'm going to be doing with King County Public Health and Seattle Children's Hospital as part of a community transformation grant. We're going to be looking at working really in-depthly with three or four hospitals in South King County. I know I've mentioned a lot of Seattle hospitals, and unfortunately, we don't have any of the hospitals in South King County signed on to the Healthy Food and Healthcare Pledge. And I'm sure many of your listeners are probably familiar with the health disparities between North King County and South King County. And unfortunately, that's something that I have not yet been able to address in my work. So I'm really looking forward to that and how we can look at changing the types of food that people in South King County have access to. Another really exciting project is going to be working on the antibiotics issue. This year, we had several hospitals, hundreds of healthcare professionals signing on to petitions to the FDA that the FDA reconsider its stance on antibiotic overuse in agriculture. And we're hoping next year that we can get some sort of a market campaign going where we can get the hospitals to join forces and really talk about how important this issue is to them.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kathy Pryor, a writer and good food advocate and program manager for the Washington Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative. Now let's talk about the South Park Fresh Starts program, a program that you helped develop.
That's right. In 2009, my then boyfriend, now husband, was working in a nonprofit in South Park in South Seattle that shared a building, that shared the community center space with the Providence Regina House Food Bank. And he got to be rather good friends with the amazing manager, Paige Collins, there. And he noticed that there was an unused greenhouse attached to the food bank. At the time we found it, it had things like old bikes in it. It had gallons and gallons of Duwamish River water in it. And it had a lot of dead plants. But my husband approached Paige, the manager there, and said, well, you know what we could do with this? We could grow plant starts for the food bank clients. And then they could take those plant starts home and grow them in their yards, their pea patches, whatever. And she loved this idea because one of the things that food banks have the hardest time having access to is fresh produce. And it's a couple different reasons. One is that a lot of them just don't have the refrigerator capacity to store fresh produce. The other part is that a lot of the stuff that gets donated is maybe past its sell-by date. So, you know, it's going to be good for a couple days max. But in terms of people having access to fresh produce throughout the week, because the food bank was only on Saturdays at that time, now it's Saturdays and Thursdays, but it was once a week that people in the neighborhood would have access to fresh produce. And so she said, yes, I love this plan, and applied for some grant funding. So we got a grant from United Way of King County, and were able to rehab the greenhouse. We were able to buy a bunch of soil and potting supplies and all of that great stuff and get the program running. So in 2009, we gave out 2,800 plant starts that people were able to take home and grow themselves. And we did everything from chilies, tomatoes, zucchini, squash. We tried to do a lot of fresh greens. We did sugar snap peas, really things that we thought would have a pretty good rate of return in the garden. And when we went and we interviewed people at the end of the season, we did a little survey, and 96% of the people said that they'd been able to actually eat food from the plants that they'd taken. So we had a really high success rate that we hadn't anticipated. 77% of those people said that they were able to eat food two times a week from their garden. So that was much better than we had thought. And so we asked Paige, do you want to do it again? And she said, yes, absolutely. So the next year we did the same project, and it has been going every summer since then. My husband and I actually have now turned it over to the volunteers at Providence Regina House Food Bank. It's entirely volunteer run. There's an incredible woman named Diane Garcia who's kept the program going. She said this year she's given out 2,700 veggie and herb starts, so she's really kept the numbers up and has done things like building an on-site garden where they can do planting demos and things like that with the food bank clients. So that's been really exciting to see.
What do you think are the prospects for replicating this success in other parts of Seattle?
I would love to see programs like this at every food bank in Seattle. It's really an incredible opportunity to help food bank clients get more control over their diets. It was really exciting to see, you know, people would kind of go through the line and then they would get to the plant station. And every other station in the food bank line, like they, you know, they're just sort of given their allotted amount of whatever product it was. And then they would get to our station and they would have to figure out, well, do I want squash? Do I want peas? Do I want tomatoes? It really gave them a control over the types of food that they would be eating over an entire growing season. I will say that we were incredibly lucky because there was a greenhouse already attached to the building. And so that was something that just made it almost a no-brainer for how easy it was. We would raise the plants in the greenhouse and then just wheel them out to the floor. I don't know of other food banks that have that. However, my dream has always been that I think the food banks would do really well to partner with nurseries or to partner with other sort of gardening centers throughout the summer to solicit donations from plants that for one reason or another, maybe they don't look pretty enough to sell anymore, whatever it may be, that they start soliciting plant donations in addition to food donations. And I think that could be really incredible for food banks across the city to start taking part in and encouraging people to grow their own food. We're very lucky. We have a mild maritime climate that makes it really easy to grow food nearly year-round if you know how to do it and if you're thinking seasonally.
Is it the case in South Park the clients happen to have some land available to them to grow? Because that might be an issue some places as well, right?
Absolutely. And that was definitely something that we found. A lot of the folks there were actually in houses where they would have small yards. But, you know, we also had people who lived in apartment complexes and they would find a little planting strip or something like that along the apartment. And they would find ways to do it. I know right now I live in an apartment without a garden per se, but we have incredible luck out on our patio growing tomatoes and leafy greens and things like that. So I really think that it's possible to do it anywhere. Also in South Park, we're very, very lucky because the food bank partners with Mara Farm. And so Mara Farm is a giving farm. So they were giving a lot of the produce to the food bank as well. And they were a pea patch. I know we had several clients who had a pea patch there where they were able to take the plant starts away and grow them in their gardens. And that's something that luckily we have access to across the city.
Another project that you've been involved with is the Truck Farm Project. What is the Truck Farm Project and what did you do in regard to it?
Oh, Truck Farm, it's a very fun, wonderful project. I can't say enough good things about it. For people who are unfamiliar with Truck Farm, it was a documentary that came out last year, and it was a documentary film by Ian Chaney, who people may know from documentaries like he did King Korn. And basically, Ian had a pickup truck, the pickup truck that he's driving around during King Korn. And he was living in Brooklyn and was sort of wanting a food project and sort of feeling like he wanted to do something hopeful. And so he built a garden in the bed of his pickup truck and then left it parked outside his apartment in Brooklyn, drove it around Brooklyn, talked to people about various urban food projects they had. And really, it was just a beautiful story of someone doing a little bit crazy that got a lot of people excited about growing their own food. So when the documentary came out, they reached out to 25 cities across the country. And my husband and I wore Truck Farm Seattle last summer, which was great. We bought a 1972 Ford F-100, and luckily it came complete with a few rust holes in the bed, so we had adequate drainage. But we planted it with a ton of different vegetables. We did tomatoes and sugar snap peas. I had lettuce and spinach. I did a little herb garden. I had nasturtium so we could talk about pollination and companion planting, things like that. And we drove it around to farmers markets. We took it to some summer day camps. We took it to some school lunch programs that were going throughout the summer. And it just gets people really excited. Their faces would light up. We did one day where we were at Pike Place Market on a sunny July day. And we probably had 5,000 people come by the truck that day. But the people who were coming by were telling us stories about how they had grown food when they were younger, or maybe how their grandparents had grown food when they were younger. And I think when you see how well something can grow in a place as strange as the bed of a pickup truck, it's empowering and it makes people feel like they would have a chance to do this at home if they wanted to.
Now, would you like to say a few words about your new book for children, Sylvia Spinach? What led you to write the book?
Sylvia Spinach has been such a wonderful project to get to talk about. Basically, I was working with part of a group that's called the Good Food Coalition that was advocating for farm-to-school funding down in Olympia. We would go to these meetings with legislatures, with Washington State Department of Ag, and people were telling these incredible stories about the impact that farm-to-school programs had had on their kids. And, of course, all of the other very smart advocates around me were thinking, oh, we need to write a white paper about this. We need to write, you know, a press release about this. And all I kept thinking was, I want to tell these stories from the kids' perspectives. And there was one parent there who told me a story about how their daughter would not eat spinach until she had grown it in her school garden. And then she ended up falling in love with her spinach. And there was something about that story that stuck with me, where I thought about, well, what sort of an emotional journey has this child gone on to do such an about face? And what would impact a child that much to change their opinion about something? And so I started thinking about a lot of the work that we had done with South Park Fresh Starts and some of the kids who had been very, very excited about what they were planting. And I started putting those pieces together. And so the story of Sylvia's spinach is a little girl hates spinach. She always says no to spinach and then is handed a packet of spinach seeds to plant in her school garden. And the process of nurturing it, waiting for it, and then finally seeing it arrive was enough of an emotional experience that she ends up falling in love with her spinach and telling her parents, yes, they can eat it and everything.
Would you also like to say a few words about your publisher, Readers to Eaters?
Readers to Eaters is a fantastic local company. This year, they have three titles out, and they're all focused on food literacy in some way. The mission of Readers to Eaters is really to connect people to where food comes from and to really get us having these conversations on a larger level. We're trying to find ways that we can reach the largest number of people possible, the people beyond the farmers market scene, beyond the food and farming conferences. How do we reach audiences that maybe aren't thinking about these issues yet?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say, in terms of all of these various food projects that I have been involved with, the most important piece of getting anything done is being willing to say yes to an unconventional idea. If I were to leave your listeners with any message, it would be to try thinking about saying yes to something unconventional this year. Maybe that could be part of a New Year's resolution. Start thinking about saying yes to something that may not seem like it's an automatic success, but that if it were to be a success, would have a wonderful implication on people's lives. So I think that would be my hope, that anyone listening here today might consider taking a chance with a good food project.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kathy.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
You have just been listening to Kathy Pryor, a writer and good food advocate and program manager for the Washington Healthy Food and Healthcare Initiative. For more information, check on the web at katherinepryor.com. That's katherinepryor.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.